It's a Pop Medic podcast for February 4th, 2015. On this episode, five white people talk about African American History Month.
It sure won't be awkward.
Wow.
This is the Pop Medic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. In the booth today is...
Amanda.
Bill.
Mike.
Jeremy.
And I'm Brian. February is African American History Month. The library will have programs at all of our branches all over the city. We'll have a link where you can see all of them. So today we're going to tell you about our favorite books, movies, and music by African Americans.
I'm excited.
First goal, not to offend. Second goal, not to be idiots. That one's a little mushy.
All right, let me tell you a little bit about Static Shock.
I put a shock to your system.
So in 1989, Marvel Comics writer-editor Dwayne McDuffie wrote a scathing memo to the company decrying their odd distinction of having two African-American characters who featured skateboards as prominent characteristics. That would be Night Thrasher and Rocket Racer, for those of you keeping score at home. Now, a couple of years later, Marvel relaunched the comic book Cage, which was a remake of a frequently embarrassing 70s comic, Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, and it was heavily inspired by blaxploitation movies. They also relaunched around the same time the character Deathlok, who was another 70s character, but this time featured an African-American man and his family. But instead of an African-American man being prominently featured, he was... trapped inside of a killing machine that sort of was like Frankenstein. And you also had Blade and other characters at Marvel. Now, so these were all characters that were at least a move away from the traditional comic book character representations of African Americans, who, in the case of Black Lightning, Black Goliath, Black Eagle, Black Vulcan, and Black Panther, all had the word black in their names. So this was at least some progress. But then in 1993, Dwayne McDuffie, artist Dennis Cowan, Michael Davis, and Derek T. Dingle started Milestone Comics, which was a company published through DC, but their characters existed in their own universe. They got a really sweet deal through DC with total creative control, copyrights for all of their characters created under the Milestone banner, and a final say on all merchandising and licensing deals pertaining to their properties. This is also, this sort of happened in the wake of Image Comics, which is a subject for a different podcast. So the goal of their company was they had original characters with an eye toward diversity. Their African-American characters were the leads, not sidekicks or supporting players. There were titles like Hardware, Shadow Cabinet, Icon, Blood Syndicate, Cobalt, and Zombie, spelled with an X. And Static, in the comic book, was called Static. The show was called Static Shock. This is probably their most prominent character. It was featured in a popular cartoon on the Kids WB that ran for 52 episodes. And the library has a DVD of the first six. We've also got a book called Static Shock Trial by Fire, which collects the first four issues of the comic, and it's a fun introduction to the Milestone universe. We meet Virgil Hawkins, a young, cocky, constantly cracking wise superhero who doesn't have much luck with the ladies, and he's just sort of making it up as he goes along. Now, he's very much in the vein of the early Spider-Man comics, but he's not just a black analog for Spider-Man. The comic is a little dated with references to Riddick Bowe and Shabba Ranks both appearing in a single dialogue bubble. It sort of screams the 90s to you, but it's a solid superhero comic with all the tropes you'd expect. And he's just a normal kid who happens to gain electrical powers after exposure to a mutagen during an event known as the Big Bang. The show is a more friendly, kid-friendly take on the comic. And what's really good about both the comic and the cartoon was there was no sort of preachy moment like Spider-Man with the great power comes great responsibility. It just sort of presented it all sort of as normal, which I really enjoyed. And Milestone Comics folded in 1997, but it was recently announced that the company's founders, minus Dwayne McDuffie, who died in 2011, they're going to restart the company sometime in the near future. And there have been no official plans made yet, but it's something to look forward to. So what do you have, Mike?
What do you have, Amanda?
Hey, Amanda.
Thanks, Jeremy.
You're welcome. Amikta.
Oh, hello. Today's romance novel is quite sexy.
I would listen to that. We're doing romance next.
Ooh, yeah.
Very down white.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Okay, so like every white girl who was raised in rural Midwestern suburbia, I came here today to school all y'all on hip-hop. It's dope. So luckily for us, I have help from... I know, so I'm really believable.
So I'm here to talk about Snow's Informer.
Well, no one knows what he's really saying. But luckily for us, I have help from Dan Charnas' book, Big Payback, The History of the Business of Hip-Hop. Now, this book is not a soap opera, but like most behind-the-scenes stories from the music business, it would make a good one. Because it has everything. It has violence, backstabbing, romance. Yeah, I got romance in there for you.
Nice.
And enough rags-to-riches story to keep Hollywood busy for years. Charnas saves it from being overly sensationable, though, because, you know, when would that happen in rap? By sticking to the facts, mostly. And folks who grew up in the Bronx in, say, late 70s, early 80s, who lived through the beginnings of the b-boy culture will really enjoy Charnas' book as a trip kind of down memory lane. But for those of us who were not raised on a coast, either east or west, we get to learn the whys of the whats. And the culture is completely different from what most of us are familiar with, what I'm familiar with. But I feel like the author does a good job setting the scene so that everyone really feels like they were at the hot spots, like, you know, disco fever and where all the events occurred. Some big names float around in the book. A few stay for the duration, like Russell Simmons, Rick Rubin, while others flare a little bit more briefly and then fade, either through rivalry on the charts or rivalry on the streets, like, you know, Tupac and Biggie. For his part, Charnas interviewed over 300 people in addition to perusing the myriad amount of court documents that there were, websites, other correspondents. The book is actually huge. It's over 600 pages long, but it is really a truly comprehensive study of not just the music, but also the business practices that have kind of emerged through the world of hip-hop. It's somewhat disappointing to me that what started as an honest expression of an underground culture has really kind of developed into a misogynistic, self-centered industry, where status is determined more, not by talent, but how blingy a person is. You know, while I personally love glitter, I don't pick my tunes based by how sparkly someone is. I want to know that you can do more than rhyme thirsty with thirsty. Just saying. And, you know, this is a broad stereotype, I will admit that. And there are still artists interested in the music, and this book covers them all, the good, the bad, and the really, really successful. And NPL has it in regular book form. If you don't want to carry around 600 pages, you can also get it in ebook from Overdrive.
I tried to get my book club to read that book, and they wouldn't.
I liked it. It was good.
Yeah, they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it.
It's really big.
Yeah, they wouldn't do it.
If you like comic books, Hip Hop Family Tree is there's two volumes of
it so far. I've seen those go through.
It's really cool. I think it's much more condensed.
Yeah, it's probably the short version of the pictures.
Russell Simmons keeps appearing in it, and he's all googly eyed and lisping. And I don't know. I mean, I've heard him speak, and he seems like his eyes are normal, and he doesn't really lisp. But it's for some reason it cracks me up every time. He's like, "This is gonna be huge." It's really,
it's really
like
Daffy
fun.
Duck.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's presented as sort of like to look like comic books of that era, like starting in the 70s and moving into the 80s. The third volume, I think, is coming out soon, but it's super cool, too.
Okay, Mike or Bill or whoever's next. Everybody's going to throw to Mike today.
I'm last. Well, I'd like to go, but, you know, I get to go fashionably late.
I'll yield to the floor.
To my fellow colleague. Yeah.
I'm going to talk about actor and director Ivan Dixon. Now you're saying, well, Bill, who's Ivan Dixon? He's probably best known for his role as Staff Sergeant Kinch of the television show Hogan's Heroes, which we have several episodes of Hogan's Heroes in our collection. Also in our collection is Car Wash, which deals with a multiracial group of workers at a Los Angeles, California car wash. The film features Richard Pryor, George Carlin, Irwin Corey, and the Pointer Sisters. Ivan Dixon probably has the best role as Lonnie, an ex-con trying to raise his two children and trying to mention Dwayne, played by Bill Duke, and try to keep him out of trouble. I highly recommend you watch this copy from our collection. His best movie is the lead role in Nothing But a Man, made in 1964. Ivan Dixon plays Duff Anderson, a railroad worker trying to do the right thing in the South. And we have that in our collection. Finally, in later years, Ivan Dixon directed The Waltons, The Rockford Files, Magnum P.I. He also directed the feature film The Spook Who Sat by the Door, in which a black nationalist infiltrates the CIA.
Raise your right hand and repeat after me.
The Spook Who Sat by the Door, the controversial best-selling novel, now becomes a shocking screen reality. The story of the first black agent in the CIA.
Whoever they select will be the best known spy since 007.
Their first mistake was letting him in.
And let me congratulate you on being the first Negro officer in the Central Intelligence Agency.
Their worst mistake was letting him out.
You really want to mess with Lanny? I can show you.
For 5 years, he was their token Negro.
Freeman, you people must serve.
For 5 years, he kept his cool.
Man, you just don't belong. I think you'd be happier with a mop in your hands.
Like your mama.
And in return, they taught him how to spy. How to fight. How to kill. For 5 years, he was the spook who sat by the door. And then, he turned gangs of ghetto kids into a highly trained guerrilla army.
We live off the land. We match technology with spontaneity and improvisation. Men against machines, brains against computers. Now, if you don't think it can work, you check out Algeria, Kenya, Korea, and Iran. Can you dig it?
He turned a summer riot into a revolution.
This is not about hate white folks. It's about loving freedom enough to die or kill for it if necessary.
He turned the American dream into a nightmare. Yesterday, a novel. Today, a movie. The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
In Mayor's office, now air conditioned, courtesy of the Black Freedom Fighters of Chicago.
The movie is based on the book by Sam Greenlee, and we have it in our DVD collection. At the time, it was quite controversial. The FBI tried to suppress the movie even, and I think they were quite successful. And only till a few years ago was it released properly on DVD. The only way you could see it was bootlegs. Huh. So we have it in our collection. Ivan Dixon died in 2008, but you can enjoy these television shows that we have in our collection. Mike?
Oh, it's Brian
finally
Stern.
Your turn.
No, it's Brian's turn. Yeah. So today I thought I would read from a selection from the book that immediately sprang to mind when I heard the topic for this week. It's from the book's introduction called Thanks for Celebrating Black History Month by Acquiring This Book. Let's see. Now to the heart of the matter. The odds are high that you acquired this book during the nationally sanctioned season for purchasing black cultural objects, also known as Black History Month. That's part of the reason why I chose February as a publication date. If you're like most people, you buy one piece of black culture per year during this month. And I'm banking on this book jumping out at you from the bookshelf or screen. Even if you're reading this book years after its original publication, it's probably February-ish on your calendar. Yeah. I bought it in January, but I read in February. that's absolutely fine. You're doing your part to celebrate blackness, whether you're black or not. So I'm going to run with that and offer you some helpful instructions on how to take a further advantage of this month. You asked for it. You got a book called How to Be Black, so don't start complaining now. So I'm, of course, reading from the satirical book How to Be Black by Baratunde Thurston. Thurston was editor of Digital for The Onion, which always, he did a series of interviews to promote this book, and always like made me chuckle when he said he was the head of digital, not like, you know. Anyway, and for a number of years, he does a variety of things online now. Last time I saw him was as a guest on The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore, which premiered recently, which is really good.
Yes.
Check it out.
It was great, yeah.
Yeah. How to Be Black is both a memoir and a semi-satirical look on what it is to be African-American in America today. Each chapter has titles like How to Be the Black Friend, Have You Ever Wanted to Not Be Black, and Can You Swim? each chapter takes a topic, and it is dissected by a black panel of artists and comedians, plus what, they included one white dude for diversity. I mean, like a lot of satire, it's both funny and really depressing. I mean, experiences of the panel, there's a chapter called When Did You First Realize You Were Black? Which is a funny title, but then the actual thing is really heartbreaking because, you know.
Horrible racist experiences.
Yes, the first time they experienced racism, and it was always as a small child. But then they'll go off on a tangent about, Thurston really has fun with people mispronouncing his name. He even had one barista call him Brad. And how whenever he talks to somebody from Nigeria, not only because it's a Nigerian name, not only do they get mad and annoyed at him, like he chose his name. There was a really funny anecdote where he calls a friend of his when he was 12, and the friend was out, but his dad was in, and his dad becomes immediately enraged upon hearing his name. It's like, you know your name's supposed to be Babatunde, right? He's like, I guess. Where'd you get that name? My parents? So it's very funny, very satirical, you know, also depressing. Good stuff. What do you got, Brian?
So the reason I wanted to go after you specifically was because I'm reading this satirical novel called I Am Not Sidney Poitier by Percival Everett. And it's about this guy whose name is Not Sidney Poitier. That's his first name is Not Sidney. That's what his mother named him.
Oh, cool.
And he doesn't know who his father is, but as he gets older, he starts to look like Sidney Poitier. So what he has to go around telling everyone, who are you? I'm Not Sidney Poitier. So obviously it's this farce about race relations because of like what Sidney Poitier represents, you know, in culture. But to make it even better, Not Sidney's mother is portrayed as a financial genius, but sort of maybe a little bit off her rocker otherwise. And she invests early in TNN, or what was Ted Turner's network?
TBS.
TBS, right? And makes all kinds of money and owns all kinds of stock in TBS. So to the point where Ted Turner actually becomes Not Sidney's godfather. and then his mother dies mysteriously, and Not Sidney goes to live with Ted Turner and Jane Fonda. And he has these interesting experiences.
His bedtime is 9:05.
As a person from Atlanta, one of my favorite Simpsons jokes ever is when the Simpsons go to Atlanta, and on the sign it says, "Welcome to Atlanta, home of Ted Turner's mood swings." So anyway.
You should read this book. That's a big part of this book. As he gets older and he starts to look like Sidney Poitier, he gets to go around telling people, yes, I am not Sidney Poitier and Ted Turner is my dad.
That's a long name tag.
Exactly. While living in Atlanta in the 80s.
Wow.
So awesome. And so after that, he tries to have like a normal life, and it's very hard just because of his name. He tries to go to college. He tries to go on his own, that kind of thing. I'm right in the middle. It's at the point where his financial advisor tells him that he should buy a television network just like Ted did, because you're Ted's godson, you have all this money, you can do whatever you want. So he buys basically the satirical equivalent of BET, and then craziness is going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen yet. I think that Ted Turner in some way is going to try to swindle him out of his money. I'm not sure how it's going to end, but it's really funny, it's short, and it's by a author that probably doesn't get read as much as he should, Percival Everett. Last week, or maybe the week before, I had talked about this book, Long Division. One of the subplots of Long Division was about this kid named Evan who was Jewish in the South in the 60s, and he was trying to explain to like black kids from now that even though he's white, the KKK still doesn't like him. And so it's sort of like this sort of like race as a social construct lesson, but that Long Division was definitely written for teens, so it was like kind of didactic. where I think in I'm Not Sidney Poitier, that same stuff is there, but it's not didactic. It's very subtle, and it's up for you to figure it out for yourself, and there are no sacred cows, and it's really hilarious, and I enjoy it a lot. Check it out. I am not Sidney Poitier.
Me either.
Hey, Amanda.
Yes, Brian.
What do we do? Wait.
So professional today.
I went to college and I learned how to catalog books, just like Mike. I don't know anything about the rest of this. Okay. Wait.
Fail.
That's what I... Seriously, that's what we learned in school, man. Okay.
I learned how to play the piano.
Why are you doing that? We're almost about to start.
You derailed it. I would.
It wasn't even me.
Who pushed us off the rails.
We got on the elevator, and he's like, hey, thanks for... Like, Kyle was like... I was talking to Kyle, and I was like... He said, thanks for getting him going. Like I'm some sort of cartoon car, you got to crank.
Well, we used to have plenty of time.
Yeah. Can I go yet? Right. Can I go yet?
Amanda.
Yes, Brian.
What do we do during the Tickle My Fancy segment?
Let's listen to Jeremy.
What comics you got, Jeremy?
Wow.
It's Pickle Jeremy
it's
Day.
Like
it's either comics or cookie butter.
Wow.
Cookie Butter Man.
Look at that waste of paper you
wasted. That's right. I printed up.
Hey, we recycle. But really, sometimes we talk about things that tickle our fancy. Jeremy does.
What are you... You're talking about things that don't?
If I get to talk.
Today's things I hate. Anyway.
Okay, so I will start. There are several jobs that make me really happy to work at the library. Instead of being an accountant or being a butcher... or a professional roller skate tester. And now I'm going to add show running to the list. So for those of you who don't know, show runners are those folks behind the scenes in TV land who, you know, run the show. They're in charge of everything. Finances, story arcs, casting, editing. Most of them write scripts. Some of them write all the scripts, which pretty much means that they don't sleep while their show's in production. That sounds really stressful to me, and I'm going to pass, but it was interesting to hear from the folks who have been there, and I saw this on a documentary that we have on Hoopla. It's called, you know, Showrunner.
Oh, I kickstarted that.
Yeah.
I chipped in $1.
Oh, nice. Thank you. It was worth watching.
The showrunner is the lifeblood of a television show. It's a collaborative art form, but you still need that one central voice through which all these marvelous creative contributions are processed.
Being a showrunner is utterly consuming. You're editing and writing and doing 100 different things at once. It's straining. It's awful. I miss it terribly.
Showrunning is like painting a painting while writing a novel while doing your taxes.
It's a billion decisions a day.
It is at the same time the best and the worst job.
The shows have become much more cinematic in their scope and intention, and yet we're expected to deliver a show every 7 days.
Things are going well on your show if everybody's just a little annoyed with you.
Action! Part of the job is being the broad shoulders of the show.
I am the king. Let's not forget that. But besides that, everybody's equal. Me and the little king, we're broach no descent.
You write something the first of the month, and then it's airing in a month. It's that urgency that's so exciting.
Wow, I have stories I want to tell. I'm going to tell them.
There's probably a certain rise in celebrity that goes along with the showrunner.
I'm just a writer, and then I turn on ABC, and there's my ugly, bald head. How the hell did this happen?
The age of showrunners being anonymous is over.
And I'll admit that I mostly watched it because I saw that Joss Whedon was going to be one of the talking heads, and I like Joss Whedon. But there were a lot of folks from other shows I liked as well, and actually there was a side kind of story arc that followed Matthew Carnahan. He's the showrunner behind House of Lies, which was just going, when they filmed this, was just going into production. Like, it showed him, you know, getting the pre-production before they shot the first season and shooting the pilot. And now it looks like it's gone on to have 3 or 4 seasons, I think, since then. So apparently, because he was, you know, it's nice to get to do it right one time time, and so he's been doing it right for, you know, 4 years, which, good for him. They also showed, you know, of course, J.J. Abrams and Damon Lindelof, and Lindelof actually had funny, and he said, you know, if someone would come to me now and say, okay, you're going to get this phone call, you know, and if you realized that for the rest of your life after you took this meeting, that you would always be the guy from Lost. Like, he's like, no matter what else I do the rest of my life, when I die, I'm going to be Damon Lindelof, that guy from Lost. And he's like, if someone would have told me that, I would have not taken the meeting. So, which I thought that was good. They also talked to the guy that did Battlestar Galactica. The two guys that ran Leverage were in there, and they had such great chemistry. You could see, I don't know if you've ever watched Leverage. I like it. It's kind of this funny con show, and they had great interaction between the two of them, so you could see how they could write a great script and run a funny show. It's not on the air anymore. We talked to Bill Prady from Big Bang Theory, and they had some fun behind-the-scenes shots of the cast and with the crew. My favorite, though, was Janet Tomorrow. She is the showrunner for Rizzoli and Isles. There was another, like, husband and wife team that runs The Good Wife. They had them on, but she was the only other woman that they interviewed, and she had some very... She was very interesting to listen to, and maybe it's because I'm a woman, and, you know, that was interesting to me. She used to be an on-air reporter for ABC News, but then she was at a crime scene one day, and she just was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, it was just because those bodies don't get back up. So then she went into television to kind of be able to fictionalize some of the experiences that she had, and she talked about what it was like. She's like, I have to be good at this because I'm a woman. And so, like, the men are good at it. She's like, I have to be good. I have to direct. I have to write. I have to, just because as a woman, you have to fight so much harder in a male-dominated world. So it was a very interesting documentary. It's only an hour and a half long. So if you've got a minute, download it on Hoopla and enjoy.
I heard someone say once that Shonda Rhimes runs ABC.
I believe that.
Yeah.
I
read just the shows, the whole network.
Right? Well, because she has all the popular shows. Yeah, so. Yeah.
I listened to an audiobook called Difficult Men that was about this third golden age of television or whatever that began with The Sopranos, Wire, Six Feet Under.
Oh, I heard about this. Yeah, it's
Breaking,
about yeah.
Breaking Bad, all the people that ran those shows. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting.
Well, they had another guy that was on, just reminded me that it was, I think it's Kurt Sutter, that's the showrunner for Sons of Anarchy. Yeah. And, like, just talking to him for 2 seconds, you totally get how that show came to be. Yeah. And he's like, because he said sometimes when you get notes from the network, like, you don't really want to take those notes. And he's like, I understand about myself. And it's taken me a while to get there. I understand about myself. Sometimes I go too far. And sometimes the notes are like, you have to step back and go, okay, maybe we don't need to show all that. We can just, you know, imply it in the dialogue. So that was it. I'm like, I don't watch that show. And after talking to, like, seeing him be, I don't want to watch that show. I'm good.
Yeah, that show's really violent for regular cable.
You said Battlestar Galactica. Mm-hmm. The dude was Ronald D. Moore. I just watched Outlander. Stars was giving a free week of...
Which we just put that on hold, too, at the library if you want to get your copy.
Because I highly recommend it. I watched the first 8 episodes, and I really enjoyed it. I watched the first one. Well, I got to see what happens next. Yeah. You know, why am I having to go to work? You know,
So he did Outlander, too?
Yeah, he wrote several of the shows.
You know, I had this back pocket tickle my fancy bill where basically I just picked on you for not watching Battlestar Galactica again. But this is why. I'm going to tell you why this came to mind. Because my partner had put in the pilot episode, and the first shot when they sort of, like, introduce all the characters is so freaking good and, like, so much better than, like, most TV. I was like, I cannot believe that Bill has not watched this show. What is that about? What is that about?
This is a challenge, Bill.
Throwing down the gauntlet.
I was like, so I was just, but anyway, I blew it now. It's out of the pocket, so I can't save it anymore.
Well, I've watched the first season, so I'm going through
them.
Excellent.
Oh,
best show ever.
I need to rewatch that.
Best show ever, and people always say I'm a snob. That was the best show because it was exciting. Because it was cliffhangers, because there were humans and robots fighting, and it made your heart go boom, boom, boom. That's why it was good. Not poetry, not drama, not art, not none of my, you know, it stomps on your heart business. Guns and robots and laser beams.
I'm confused. What have you done with Brian?
I can see that.
Okay. Mike, what's tickling your fancy this week?
Did you go, or was that your go?
Oh, I'm sorry, Bill.
I've got a real tickling fancy.
Yeah.
I was just trying to be engaging.
I was trying to join the conversation.
Okay, tickling my fancy is a book called Silver Screen Things, Learning About Life from an Addiction to Film by Patton Oswalt. It's more about Patton Oswalt, the Los Angeles comedy scene, writing sketches, how he got started, writing sketches for Mad TV, and, of course, being obsessed with the movies. I'm recommending the book. I enjoyed the entire book. It's a very short read, but one of the most fascinating chapters is he talks about Jerry Lewis's The Day the Clown Cried, this unreleased movie that Jerry Lewis starred and directed in. And it was about a clown who led children to the gas chamber. And this movie has a whole history to it, and about how Jerry Lewis never talks about it.
It's been finished, but he won't release it.
Won't show it to anybody. And you know, when the book goes into, he supposedly keeps a copy of a video cassette in his briefcase at all times. You know, it's just one of these. There's wild stories about it, and he goes into some of these, his own personal experience with this movie. So just to read that section, that chapter, is well worth it. I recommend Silver Screen Fiend, Learning About Life from an Addiction to Film by Patton Oswalt. We also have it on audio CD, and Patton Oswalt reads it.
I'm listening to it right now.
Yeah,
I'm next in the whole list, I think. Oh, boy.
Michael.
So excited. Okay, well, mine's super short today. Hey, cable cutters. Guess what? Venture Brothers Season 6 began on January 20th. Woo! Apparently, there was an hour-long special. I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard everything. It's supposed to be really amazing. Oh, boy. We got Jeremy.
Wow.
Well, you know, I've talked a bunch the past couple episodes. You missed out, listeners. You know, it was like a 2-hour epic on the awesomeness of Creepshow last time that, you know, Brian cut down to a serviceable minute and a half. So, you know, I thought this time I would be like, you know, I think I'll just go really short.
Yeah, I didn't listen to anything. That Creepshow is awesome.
Pretty much, yeah.
Creepshow, cool.
Good, amazing.
Listen, watch it.
So, tickling my fancy is intrapersonal conflict.
This is your podcast.
Oh, yeah. Let's make fun of you some more.
Yeah. No. I don't know what's tickling my fancy. So my wife and I, for the first couple of years of my son's life, my wife did not want my son to watch television at all. Like, we couldn't have the TV on because, like, she's like, he's just staring at it.
Right choice.
Like, that's what it's for.
Now, good choice.
And it was a perfectly good choice because now, like, the example I always use is he will jump up and down, constantly make noise, never stop talking like his father, always move around, jumping, kicking, screaming, shouting, blowing into a recorder, hitting a drum, constantly in motion, and then he will stop everything. In the middle of his own birthday party, he did this, sit down with a book in his lap and just fall into it. He's recently pulled off the shelf. I have a large hardcover collection of Mad Magazine's The Lighter Side Of by Dave Berg. Yeah. He has taken it upon himself. He cannot read except for a few sight words. Will sit and just stare at the thing. He did it this morning after he's sitting in his Batman zip-up pajamas with The Lighter Side Of in his lap. So anyway, all that is to say, we've always struggled with stuff that we will let him watch once we finally started letting him watch stuff. Charlie, he watches like the Charlie Brown specials a lot. His favorite is the one called The Mayflower Voyagers, which is kind of like a C-list Charlie Brown special.
Yeah, wow. Can you remember
yeah,
that
it's
one?
Not oh. very memorable unless you've seen it 400 times. But we slowly have added things like Mary Poppins or Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, like Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Pee-wee's Playhouse, stuff like that we like, but also like feel comfortable with. And one of the things that I really wanted him to watch was Adventure Time, because it was a fun show. I'd watched it a little bit, and I thought, he's going to really like this. And he really did love it. But my wife thinks that he gets a really bad attitude from it, because the characters kind of tell each other to shut up a lot, and she doesn't like that. And they also, like, use swords and things, and she is afraid of weapons. So what happens is when he goes to bed, we will watch it for 2 hours, and it is a complete, like, mind-melting program to watch.
That one of the most weird
it
things.
It is so of, weird and yeah. amazing, and they're sometimes, like, there was, like, a whole episode, which is only, like, 15 minutes or 12 minutes or whatever, that was basically just led up to a fart joke, and I came home from work and they were both still laughing about it, and she was telling me about it, made me watch it, and it was great. And then my son, we watched it again with him one time, because we keep going back and forth between letting him watch it and not letting him watch it, and then us watching it constantly. And one of the greatest joys I've had this year so far is watching that show with my wife and then just turning and looking at her jaw is just like on the floor, and she's like, what the hell is this? We'd seen it before, but there's something about watching it in big blocks with someone you love that just helps your brain melt and feel really good. But it is a really, really good program for children of all ages.
Better or worse than SpongeBob?
Better than SpongeBob.
SpongeBob has really a varying quality. Some episodes I really like, and then other ones I've seen are just like, man.
I like SpongeBob, and we had a similar experience with SpongeBob too, but it didn't have like a... There was not a lot of depth to it, I guess, so even though it's under the sea.
I say he lives in a pineapple under the sea.
Yeah. But it had lots of good jokes and stuff, but it didn't have like a rewatchability to it, and it didn't have the world of it didn't feel like the world of Ooh where Adventure Time takes place feels like a real place where nothing is real. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean it is amazing. And the comic book is actually really good too. So boom.
Oh, wow.
I have to do tons of work for those comics, so you better enjoy them.
I do enjoy them.
All of them require original cataloging.
Oh, yeah?
I don't really want to. Yeah, because we get them the millisecond that they're published, so they're not in OCLC. So guess who has to do work?
Oh, sorry.
Not work! Oh, no!
Actual work. One, I'm glad that it's both popular with kids and adults, just because, like, you know, some of the shows that adults like more than the kids get canceled swiftly.
Oh, yeah, sure. You read
the behind-the-scenes stories on, like, Batman the Animated Series.
Oh, sure.
Or Thunder the Barbarian, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff where, like, you know, adults really liked it. Kids, eh. So, yeah. Like, since the kids weren't watching it, pull the plug.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, that's they're selling for toys.
Yeah. Yeah, if they're advertisers.
Adults don't buy toys.
Yeah. Speaking of showrunners, you know, Pendleton Ward, mm-hmm. the person that created Adventure Time, yeah. you know, that I think that he actually left the show because he's like, the show running process was just like, oh my.
Yeah.
You know,
well, they said every one of them across the board said it's an absolute nightmare. Like, you have to just be like committed to your soul to do it.
We don't have Creepshow.
No.
I was going to commit ritual seppuku after this.
So that was an in-show correction, but maybe the post-show retroactive correction would be, I left this line in the show about letting you guys riff about Creepshow because most of us here are Stephen King fans.
Not it either,
but you know, whatever, I let everybody have their fun. And actually, the spot about Creepshow wasn't really that long because I cut it all down.
It used to be much longer, listeners. Yeah. You missed out on our gleeful ripping.
Well, there's a little bit at the end. And the library is ordering a copy of Creepshow. Woo! So see? Hopefully...
Affecting change from the inside.
Hopefully in a week or two, Creepshow... Back
I just
stock.
Assumed it's a classic that we have, you know, like Silas Marner or Tristram Shandy.
For more information about these and other classics, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Frank Zappa.
Oh, that'd be amazing. What's this last thing we found on his computer files?
The central scrutinizer.
I'm scared now.
Girl, you thought he was a man, but he was a muffin.
Theme music is by Adam Dean.
Yeah, thanks, Adam.
Next week, be my Valentine.
Aww.
Can we do a musical episode?
You've heard me sing.
All the good ones have.
The horror, the horror. It was quite exciting.
I read this book. It was long.
Yeah, if we could do Resident Evil, I guess we could do it.
Yeah, I'm not writing the whole score. Sorry.
No, that ain't happening.
I've got a little Casio. I'll bring it in. Just hit one of the pre... Yeah, the pre... Yeah, exactly.
Listen to that.
Be like just talking over like the... Wesley Willis or something.
And then put the samba on.
Yes.
I had one of those.
We have gone off the rails already.
Yeah, wow. We were like well, a minute
if,
in, maybe.
If we did the Wesley Willis thing, we could do it. Right? That's what we're shooting for.
Creepshow, it stars Ted Denson. Creepshow! Creepshow! Electech, it's a computer wonderland.
How many people get this Wesley Willis
reference? Yeah, if I knew who Wesley Willis was, like, this really, should be
really
hilarious.
Really good Wesley Willis.
Thanks.
You don't hear that every day.
Wesley Willis was like a schizophrenic man in Chicago who would go up to people and he had a callus on his forehead from headbutting strangers and he would perform music with a Casio keyboard and he would just like hit whatever key and then it would play in that key and then the next song would be the same thing, the same beat, but just in a different key.
You just hit F.
And he would have a song about Johnny Depp and it'd be like, Johnny Depp, you star on 21 Jump Street. You went on to such films as Crybaby and the Johnny Depp, Johnny Depp. And then he would say like the tagline like the of an advertisement from like some is like Electech or something. It's a computer wonderland. Or, you know, Family Leisure, where family and fun come together.
You are a working class dog. You are a busy man. You own the Viper Room in Hollywood, California. You can really call the shots. Johnny Depp! Johnny Depp! Johnny Depp!